to hear All Things Reconsidered. That's right, you are here for another edition of All Things Reconsidered. My name is Bruce Birch, and I am your host for the evening. And tonight we have Mark Ortiz with us from Kannapolis, North Carolina, who's going to be doing a fairly lengthy interview with us about his congressional race. And also we have Peter G. from Tallahassee, and I really enjoy saying that. Peter G. from Tallahassee. We're going to be talking about democracy and religion and democracy. And you know what? It's really going to be an interesting interview, and I'm looking forward to that. But the biggest part of what I'm looking forward to tonight is spending some time with you. And I'd just like to say thank you for tuning in to All Things Reconsidered. You can reach us online at www.thetruthis.us/ATR. This show is archived by White Rose Society. Thank you so much, Ben Birch. You are the man. Hopefully we'll be doing a stream through his service pretty soon. Also, we have an interesting announcement coming up toward the end of the show about 12th Harmonic, so stay tuned for that. This is All Things Reconsidered. I'm on the phone now with Mark Ortiz from Kannapolis, North Carolina, and Mark is ran in the 8th District against, was running against Robin Hayes in the last congressional election in 2004. Mark, how are you doing tonight?
Doing fine, and thanks for having me on.
Fantastic. We're glad you're on All Things Reconsidered. Mark, I guess the first question really is, what sort of prompted you to get involved in politics? I know that you have a long history of political activism. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, what made it impossible for me to ignore politics was that I came of age in the era of the draft. And at that time, my country was, much as it is now, involved in an illegal and immoral war that had been sold to the American population based on lies. I had the good fortune to find out about at least some of the lies before I became draft age. So by the time I was 18, I was already an anti-war activist and an activist against the draft. And I have been politically active on and off since then, have done some radio myself.
Okay.
Years ago in California, not recently. I consider political involvement to be a moral and civic duty. It isn't something that I see as a career. I see it as something that a responsible citizen, if they've got the brains and the time, should get involved in. It's something you should do as part of leaving a better world when you pass on. It really is as simple as that.
You said you were involved in it, in political activities during Vietnam. What sort of things were you involved in at that point?
I attended one of the very big anti-war demonstrations at that point, the March on the Pentagon in 1967. I didn't attend all the demonstrations in Washington. I was living in Ohio and Wisconsin at that time,
Okay. So
it was a long trip to Washington. But I also participated in just about all the peace demonstrations that occurred during that time in my hometown, which was Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I was just active as much as I could be. Wrote for a paper called Our Town.
And that was in Eau Claire?
That was in Eau Claire.
Okay.
And did some draft counseling as I was able.
Okay. So basically counter...
Victor myself during the time of the draft.
Okay.
Did my alternative service investigating ecologically sound lifestyles for 2 years, which I pretty much had to put together myself, and that was done under an agency called the Greater Milwaukee Conference on Religion and Urban Affairs.
Interesting.
And by the time the draft ended, there were so many people gaining conscientious objector status, and the draft boards had so much difficulty finding 2 years of alternative service work for them, especially since a lot of us deliberately threw sand in the gears and tried to delay them and tie them up as much as we could by being difficult to place. The Greater Milwaukee Conference on Religion and Urban Affairs ended up, by the end of the draft, employing a third of the conscientious objectors in the state of Wisconsin, most of them doing projects of their own invention.
Was there a lot of organization among that entire group of people at that time?
Oh, yeah. The movement at that time was, at least as much as it is now, a very disparate hodgepodge of different philosophies, different cultural groups, different racial groups that had all sorts of different nuanced opinions on exactly what should be done, much like today, probably even more so because by the time it ended, it was bigger.
Yeah, and we've seen that some with ANSWER, you know, and United for Peace and Justice also in the anti-war movement or at this point.
Organizers of the recent march, certainly.
Yeah. So your political involvement began, in 67 and has moved forward. How long have you been in North Carolina?
6 years.
6 years.
Half now.
6.5 years, okay. And when you came to North Carolina, did you already know folks here who were involved politically, or did you just sort of like end up here and as a part of your natural outgrowth, get involved?
Well, I didn't know anybody. My first political involvement here was actually with the embryonic Green Party, which remains embryonic to this day, but not dead. I'm no longer affiliated with them. You can't register Green because the party isn't recognized in North Carolina. It's an organization that you join by paying dues, or if you can't afford dues, you tell them you want to join and would like a waiver of the dues.
Okay.
That's what makes you a member or not. Currently, I'm not. But in any case, in the 2000 election, after the 2000 election, there was a move afoot in North Carolina to try to challenge the unwillingness of the state to count Nader's write-in votes, Nader being the Green nominee in 2000.
Sure.
Statewide organizer Doug Stuber put out a call for people who had voted for Nader to try to contact him, and since I had, that was my initial contact, and of course they did everything they could to try to get people who contacted them involved with the party, so I ended up being the state treasurer for a year and a half.
Wow, so that's pretty impressive. Did you guys, how did the vote come out? Were they counted?
Oh, they were not.
They were not.
Because the way it works for an unrecognized party running a write-in candidate is that you have to submit the necessary number of signatures, which is not very high. It's only 500 for a statewide race. This organizer, who was from out of state, was unaware of the procedure until too late. He was originally trying to get a much larger number of signatures to get Nader on the ballot. You have to get 1% of the most recent vote for governor or president, whichever is less.
Wow.
Usually it's governor, and that ends up being somewhere on the order of 60,000 signatures. And some, of course, get thrown out, so you need some extra.
Sure. Okay.
He was trying to do that most of the race, and he wasn't really up to speed on the fallback procedure of trying to get write-in votes counted. You have to get those signatures in North Carolina, 500 signatures for a statewide race, or your write-in votes don't count. They don't even, if nobody does that, they don't even put a line on the ballots for people to write a candidate in.
That's North Carolina. I think I could be wrong, but I believe they decertified the Libertarian Party this year also, didn't they?
They did, and that's normal. In fact, in order to remain certified without petitioning, you have to get 10% of the vote for president or governor. Then you are automatically on the ballot for the next four-year cycle. But since the Libertarians have never done that, nor has any other minority party, they have had to petition every 4 years, all the time that they have been a recognized party. Costs them plenty of money and work, as you can imagine.
Sure, sure.
They haven't completed that procedure. I am not sure whether they intend to. I would think that they would. But in any case, since we are less than a year since the past election, they haven't got their signatures in yet, and so their current status is that they're unrecognized.
You know, dual membership in political parties, what's your stance on that? I mean, I noticed in your last in the leaflet that you that I've been able to see that's online, you were a member of the Green Party and a registered Democrat, but ran as a Democrat. Are you not allowed to run as a Green in North Carolina? Is that?
Well, if you run as you cannot run as a Green as far as the State Board of Elections is concerned because the party is unrecognized. If you are a member of an unrecognized party, the party can endorse you if it so decides. But that carries no weight as far as what appears on the ballot. As far as the state is concerned, you are an unaffiliated candidate, regardless of whether you are a member of that unrecognized party or are truly unaffiliated.
Okay.
So basically, the only way an unaffiliated candidate can run is either get those 60,000 or so signatures or run as a write-in.
Okay. Well, I know that, I mean, this probably is not going to matter a whole lot to a lot of the listeners as far as the nuts and bolts, but, you know, I'm asking this just to give people a snapshot, you know, of the difficulty of running a minority party in the state of North Carolina. The Democrats and the Republicans in this state have really sealed off any chance of there being anything more than a two-party system.
We have the second or third most restrictive ballot access laws of all the states in the Union. Georgia is probably a little worse. Most states are way better.
Right. And, you know, and that makes a big difference.
Next door is unusually lenient. I believe it's 300 signatures and you're on the ballot.
And that's in Tennessee?
Correct.
Okay, well, let's move forward a little bit to your candidacy. Now, you know, you've been here 6 years. You were the treasurer of the state treasurer of the Green Party. What motivated you to run for Congress in the 8th District?
I thought that the country was in crisis, and the main crisis was at the federal level. And that's why I didn't try to work myself up from dog catcher. I didn't see politics as a career. I see it as a civic responsibility, as I mentioned. And I thought that the country was really sliding into fascism in the sense that elections, even the 2000 election, and I believe the 2004 election, at least at the presidential level, were both fixed.
You are not alone in that belief.
I am not. And we were embarked on a course of a series of aggressive invasions of other countries that had not attacked us. We were run by corporate big business. So you have most of the fundamental ingredients that were present in classical fascism in Germany, in Italy, in Spain. You have corporate rule. You have an aggressive foreign policy. You have an absence of properly run elections.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's got to stand up and say something.
And
that was why I ran.
And you did.
And that's why I'm doing it again.
Okay. Well, we'll get to the current race right after this break. I'm talking with Mark Ortiz, who is from Kannapolis, North Carolina, and he is running in the North Carolina 8th District for Congress. I'd just like to remind you that you are listening to All Things Reconsidered. You can reach us online, www.thetruthis.us. Tonight's interview is with a gentleman named Mark Ortiz. Mark is running for the 8th District in North Carolina against Robin Hayes. We'll be right back. We're back with Mark Ortiz, who is running North Carolina 8th District for Congress. Mark, I wanted to ask you a little bit about Robin Hayes, who is the Republican opponent in this race. You know, one thing for sure that I know about him is that he is the largest receiver of funds from the delay arm pack or trim pack, which I'm not sure which, because delay has so many of them. But tell me about some of that stuff.
Well, he is, as far as I know, the largest recipient. I saw something like, I guess, $1,000, I think, from that pack.
Yeah, I think it was 48,000. Yeah,
definitely the largest in North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
Although other Republican Congress members have also received substantial, like five-digit amounts from DeLay's pack.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Hayes has been in office since 1998. Is a very wealthy man in his own right. Is canon by marriage. Some people would say he's a loose one, but I mean that he's a member of canon family, as in canon towels.
Right, and for people who aren't familiar with North Carolina, the canon family operated a large textile business here.
Basically, they started the town of Kannapolis.
Okay.
Basically, Kannapolis was not incorporated until the mid-80s, despite the fact that it was founded in 1905.
Uh-huh.
Basically, it was the archetypal company town. The company provided the police protection, the fire protection, owned a great many of the houses in
probably,
which the mill workers lived.
They probably printed their own money, too, huh?
The did you say?
I'm sorry. What I said was they probably printed their own money. A lot of the...
I don't know about that.
In a lot of the mill towns in the South, there was a thing called a company store, and the mill owners owned the store, and they would pay their workers in what was called company script, which was basically money that they could spend at the company store. And so what would happen is, you know, when they were paid in this company script, I mean, it pretty much was a way to keep people indentured, and, you know, instead of paying them in real money so that they could move. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And a lot of times, I mean, you know, I've spoken with a number of people who in the early times of North Carolina, and actually all across the South, that, you know, there was a booming business with buying this company script money for, you know, 50 cents on the dollar. So, you know, it was another way of creating servitude, if you will.
Yep. Well, I don't know enough local history to tell you if there was company script in Kannapolis or not.
Yeah.
But I do know that the workers were extremely dependent on the company.
Sure.
In a wide variety of ways. And it was, by some accounts, a more benevolent form of paternalism than was practiced in many towns. But there was no question that it was an aristocratic system, and there was enormous concentration of power and wealth.
Sure.
In any case, Mr. Hayes is a canon on his mother's side. That's why his name isn't canon.
Okay.
His father married into the family. So a large part of his fortune comes from the original sale of the Kannapolis Mill, which happened sometime in the early 90s before I got here, and it was then handed around from owner to owner, and various opportunists systematically gutted it of its assets, sold off the real estate, sold off the machinery, sold off just about everything but the brand name, until they finally closed the company years ago here.
So he has a legacy of well, special interests over the welfare of the people.
That's where his bread has been buttered his whole life. I mean, if a person from that background doesn't qualify as ruling class, I don't know what would.
Yeah, and especially in southern towns, absolutely. I mean, you know, I know the dynamic, and it is still very pervasive today. Probably not as much because most of that is outsourced now, and you know, the people, you know, they don't wield as much power over the common folks as they used to.
Remains to be seen where all of this is going to go. The world isn't going to stop needing towels, that's for sure.
That's true. So one day you decided to run against Mr. Hayes. What went through your mind that day that you were making that decision?
Of course, it wasn't a decision that was made in a day.
Okay.
I talked to a number of people. I realized I would be dramatically financially outgunned. There's about a two-week filing period in which you have to officially declare to the state government that you are going to run, and you pay a filing fee. That's what makes it official. I waited a week into the filing period. Nobody had filed yet. So I did. The filing period closed at noon on a Friday, and I believe it will again next year also. It will be the last Friday in February.
Okay.
Filing period is the last half of February, basically. Thursday night, right before the Board of Elections office closed, my one competitor in the primary filed. And so if I had wanted to withdraw my filing, I would have had to hightail it up to Raleigh and get there before noon.
Right.
And withdraw, in which case they refund your money. And at that point, you are then eligible to run for that seat as an unaffiliated if you want to. But I did not choose to make any such effort, so I was in.
Okay.
That was how the process went.
Okay.
Of course, that somewhat ignores the political and philosophical logic of the decision, but that was the mechanics of it.
Sure. When you realize that you had an opponent in the primary, I mean, how did that? This is another Democrat, and she
correct.
It was a lady, right?
Yes, her name was Beth Troutman.
Beth Troutman,
and she's still around. She's working for the Fox News Channel in Charlotte.
Well, we're not big fans of Fox News Channel at All Things Reconsidered.
Bygones are bygones, and we tried to avoid acrimony, and I think we did a pretty good job of it. But we're still friends. If she enters the race again, though, I will lose no time labeling her a Fox News Democrat.
And her platform probably was more of the establishment Democratic platform, is that correct?
Definitely, and not anti-war. Remember, the war on Iraq was already well underway at that point.
Sure, sure.
And her position was basically the same as it is now. She has discussed it on TV, so I have some awareness of her current thinking. And she is and was then of the opinion that we should stay in, basically. That we can't get out now, it'll be a bloodbath, and when should we get out? Well, she doesn't ever say.
So it's more of a stay the course, and hopefully one day the sun will shine, huh?
Mission, whatever that is.
Right.
You mentioned that there were no declared Democratic candidates. There is one.
There is one this year, okay.
And his name is Tim Dunn.
Tim Dunn, okay.
And he is, I forget what his rank is, but he's in the Marine Reserve, and he is an Iraq vet.
Wow.
And he is one of a number of Iraq vets that the DLC and the Dean leadership has tried to recruit around the country. They have sprouted like mushrooms following the relative success of Paul Hackett.
Sure. Now, last count that I know of, there's six of them. Now, I don't know if there's more since then, but I think this was maybe a month ago that I counted six. But I wasn't aware of Mr. Dunn, so he may be number seven.
Okay, well, he's been around for a while. He's and there have been newspaper stories about him. There were a couple of other candidates who were considering running. One of them was Rick Glazier, who is a state representative at present. He has announced that he will seek re-election to his state House of Representatives seat, which pretty much rules out him running for anything else.
Right.
So he's out. The other possible contender was Chris Curry of Charlotte, and he won, I believe, a five-way primary in 2002 and did run against Mr. Hayes. And did fairly well, probably has done the best of any Democrat so far against Mr. Hayes, despite being outspent about 4-1. Chris spent about $500,000, and Robin Hayes spent about $2.3 million.
Wow. Well, you know, but it's so much is at stake, and I don't think I can emphasize that enough. Tell me, now I know that there's been a couple of House votes that Mr. Hayes has cast the deciding vote. One of them was CAFTA.
Right. The most recent was CAFTA. And the previous one, right before the 2004 election, was Fast Track Trade Authority. Again, these are both measures that make it easier for corporations to outsource our jobs. But it's succinctly. And in both cases, Mr. Hayes waited and cast the last vote, and it was the deciding vote.
Has he ever explained why he waited to give the deciding to cast the last vote? I mean, is that something that he was not decided upon and had his arm twisted enough till he got what he wanted? Is that
basic? Until the people twisting his arm got what they wanted, yeah. Basically, Mr. Hayes depends heavily on all the money that the Republican Party puts behind him. The Republican Party knows that the 8th District is traditionally a very close race. Even when Democrats have won it, and they have in the past on occasion, it's close. As long as the Democrats put up a viable candidate, the race tends to be very close, partly because the district by registration is very heavily Democratic. It's like, of course, the numbers float a little bit over time, but the district is slightly over 50% Democratic by registration, about 36 or 37 or 38% Republican by registration, and around 14% unaffiliated.
And just so folks know, does this include Charlotte or just part of Charlotte?
Just part of Charlotte. It includes about 15% of Mecklenburg County.
Okay.
It includes the UNC Charlotte area. It includes the Plaza Midwood neighborhood and some areas south of the Plaza Midwood neighborhood. In other words, more or less southeastern portions of Charlotte.
Okay, and these areas are largely Democratic?
Quite a bit Democratic, yes.
Okay. So we know where Mr. Hayes stands, and we also know where the faux news lady stands. Where do you stand, Mark?
Well, on the war, I'm against it.
Okay.
Like you, I went to Washington and demonstrated against it, and I've been against it from the outset.
Okay.
I was one of those standing on street corners with signs saying "Don't invade" before it even started.
Right.
So my position is clear and unequivocal. It's a war of aggression against a country that never attacked us, was not about to attack us, didn't have weapons of mass destruction, didn't have a nuclear program, was not connected to 9/11, therefore in no way deserved to be invaded and have a bunch of its citizens killed. The only ethical course is to get out. Some people say we can't do that, we broke it, we have to fix it. I say that is a case for reparations, not occupation.
You couldn't put it any better. That's now there's a soundbite, and we need more people like you out there fighting for these seats, because in reality, I believe that the American people are fed up with this whole debacle there in Iraq, and they're tired of hearing the same old rhetoric. I mean, it's a fresh face and a fresh voice, I believe, will carry the day in this next election. And, Mark, I certainly hope you are the fresh voice and the fresh face that can do that.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Mark Ortiz, Democrat for Congress in the 8th U.S. Congressional District, North Carolina. You can make donations to Mark. Mark, you want to tell us how our listeners can do that?
They were set up right now. You need to send me a check. And you make that out to Mark Ortiz for Congress.
And that would be Mark Ortiz, O-R-T-I-Z.
O-R-T-I-Z. Looks like Ortiz, but it's Spanish, so it's pronounced Ortiz. It rhymes with release.
Okay.
For Congress, send it to 155 Ankle Drive, W-A-N-A-E-L Drive, Annapolis, North Carolina, that's K-A-N-N-A-P-O-L-I-S, North Carolina, 28083. Again, Mark Ortiz, O-R-T-I-Z, 155 Wankel Drive, W-A-N-K-E-L Drive, Annapolis, North Carolina, 28083.
And, just to sort of tie all this up, I really am grateful that you came on the program with us tonight and shared your views. And you're welcome, and we will keep tabs with you as this develops. We'll probably have you on a few more times, Mark. You're an interesting guy, and I look forward to interviewing you again.
Anytime.
Okay. Have a great evening.
You bet. You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
And that was Mark Ortiz, who is running for the North Carolina 8th Congressional District for Congress. He is, you can reach him online at Mark Ortiz for Congress. That's MarkOrtiz for Congress .org. He'll be facing Tim Dunn, who is an Iraq war veteran, and hopefully, if he's able to win the primary, which we're going to think positive and say he will, he is going to be running up against Robin Hayes, who is a favorite son of the Republican Party. Next up, we've got an interview with Peter G. from Tallahassee, and should be an interesting one, so stick around. This is All Things Reconsidered. My name is Bruce Birch. You can reach us online at www.thetruthis.us. Tonight with Peter from Tallahassee, Florida, and Peter's going to be talking with us about the church and how, and democracy and how the two sort of influence each other. How are you doing tonight, Peter?
Well, I'm doing well, Bruce, and I want to thank you for allowing me to be on the show.
Absolutely.
It's a privilege to be here, and there's so many things that are in my heart that I want to share with you guys. I should say at the very beginning before I get into anything, but I'm using some points from several people, Catherine Eureka, Bill Moyer, and Scott Peck, and if I've missed anybody, it's certainly not intentional.
Okay, before Catherine Eureka, I know Scott Peck wrote The Road Less Traveled, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And we all know who Bill Moyer is. He is a hero of the left.
Pardon me?
I said we all know who Bill Moyer is. He's a hero of the left.
And Catherine Eureka has a website called the Eureka Report.
Oh, okay, great.
A very useful site.
Okay.
In fact, I think I mentioned that when I was on the show the last time.
Sure.
See, where do I begin? I guess I really should begin by telling the listeners what I am and what I believe and what I am not.
Okay.
And first of all, I need to tell you that I'm not an evangelist, and I'm not here to save souls for God or to convince anyone that their particular faith or religion or belief system is inferior in any way or that it should be changed. And I speak only for myself, and of course my words are colored by my own experiences within the church and within the world. And in fact, let me go so far as to say that I believe in the concept of coming to your own personal understanding of good and evil. I had to do that, and for any spirituality to be valid, we all have to do that. And as for saving people, I say, save yourself. That's what I had to do. And I ask that you understand what I'm saying tonight by knowing what Jesus said. And he said, I am the truth and the light. And whether or not you accept Jesus as being the truth and the light is entirely up to you. Irregardless of your acceptance as to whether Jesus was the truth and the light, you must at least believe in truth and light as a standard. And it's a standard that we have to live by. And if you don't accept truth and the light, you're either a Republican or a criminal, which of course is redundant.
Which is that is redundant in today's government, isn't it?
Yes, it is. This country is badly damaged. Indeed, the planet has been severely injured by the Bush regime. We're walking around like the wounded dead. Our spirits are cast down. Our minds are troubled, and we're tired of the fight. We're angry. We're sad, and our spirits have been injured by this man. I'm wondering how we can help heal the hurt and the divisions that this illegitimate presidency has wrought upon our lives, and what can be done to regain any semblance of respectability to the church after the right so thoroughly destroyed its credibility. And I say that there are many Christian voices that are unheard. There are many who are able to articulate that voice far better than I could ever do, and I beg you, the listeners, to let your voices be heard. Bruce has given us a platform that allows us to freely speak truth to power. And if you're one of those voices and you choose to remain silent, well, may God have mercy on you.
Because the Bush regime surely won't.
Yes. Like the conservative Christians, we attend church. We read the Bible and we say our prayers, but there the similarity ends. And it ends with extreme prejudice. Disciples of Christ are far less willing to allow our personal codes of conduct to be translated into statutes, not because of a lack of faith in God, but because we acknowledge the limitations of human beings. We know that man is inherently flawed and cannot and should not legislate morality. For us, living the love commandment is at odds with efforts to make Christianity a political agenda. We strongly support the separation of church and state because that principle is essential to holding together a diverse community and country. And because the policies of the state always fall short of faith, we can't leave it up we just can't leave it up to them.
Sure.
We're aware that ventures into politics are efforts to carry the treasures of Christ in an earthen vessel, and it's the vessel of government. And we walk in a spirit of humility that's lacking in the conservative Christian.
Why do you think that is, Peter?
That has to do with ego, the insertion of self into the church, the difference between we speak for Christ and Christ speaks for us, and people like me who feel that no one speaks for God.
Right.
God can speak for himself. Jesus said, all the law can be expressed in one sentence, and that sentence is love the Lord our God with all of our hearts, minds, souls, and love our neighbors as ourselves. And this sentence is the foundation of democracy. Loving one's neighbor as ourselves necessarily implies the concept of equality. The only absolute standard of behavior is the commandment to love our neighbors as ourselves. And repeatedly in the gospel we find that the love commandment always takes precedence when it conflicts with law.
Say
it another way, Christian democracy must protect the right of minorities. Minorities must have the same rights as the majority to speak and be heard. It's horrifying to me when laws are passed that this single question is not asked. Does this law hurt anybody? If so, who does it hurt? Why are they hurt? In our democracy, we're required to protect the rights of minorities. And we're also required to separate our personal beliefs from our obligation to serve all the people in a non-discriminating way. This, of course, comes from loving our neighbors as ourselves. This is interesting statistics I came across. Only 40% of Americans can name more than four of the Ten Commandments, and only half can cite any of the four authors of the Gospel. 12% believe that Joan of Arc was Noah's wife.
Wow.
And
because he had the Ark.
It's amazing. This failure to recall the specifics of our Christian heritage, it may, of course, be evidence of the national decline in education, but it really doesn't matter all that much in spiritual or political terms. But here's a statistic that does matter. 3/4 of Americans believe the Bible teaches that God helps those who help themselves. That is, 3 out of 4 Americans believe that this is an instruction from God rather than a counter-biblical phrase uttered by Ben Franklin. Few ideas can be further from the gospel message. The gospel message has a radical summons to love our neighbor.
Sure.
On this matter, most American Christians are simply wrong. The only analogy I can give you, it's as if 75% of the American scientists believe that Newton proved gravity causes apples to fly up. It's that fundamentally flawed. From this, we can see that America has already deviated from Christian standards, and there's an effort by the Republican Dominionist government to shut down the voices of everyone in America except their own.
Okay, wait a minute. Hang on, Peter. When you say Republican Dominionist, what do you mean by Dominionist?
The Dominionist movement believes that that separation of church and state is a myth. That by any means necessary, it is important to control the populace of this country by laws and any means necessary until Jesus comes.
Okay.
It's evil and it's flawed and it is in effect man stealing control from God, in my opinion. A lot of it comes from the Texas Republican Party. Texas Republican Party, you remember, produced George Bush, it produced Karl Rove, it produced Tom DeLay, and it's ground zero for the most evil and divisive activism in the Republican Party nationwide. As for the influence of the Republican Party, it's become huge. And more often than not, considering who the Texas Republican Party has reduced, it's as though we're specifically fighting against the Texas Republican Party for control of the national agenda rather than the Republican National Committee. There's a lot of evidence that's happening because of the divisions that you're seeing now in the Republican Party. It's almost as if the Republican Party itself is now taking issue with the Texas Republican Party.
Sure, and I can't help but wonder how much of that is as a result of some of the money that Tom DeLay was able to funnel to, you know, hundreds of Republican congressmen.
Ah, very good point.
You know,
yes, money does rule in that sphere, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
If we look back at history, I want to get back to democracy again. If we look at history, we see that an Italian priest is Savonarola. He was an Italian priest, and he lived in Florence under the Medicis, and he's credited in history with creating the first democracy. You won't be surprised, I'm sure, that he was tortured and burned at the stake by the church. But there's a report of his death that illustrates what happened. After he was tortured all night on the rack, he was led up a ramp where a priest awaited him. And the priest spoke, "I separate you from the church militant and from the church triumphant." And Savonarola corrected him, saying, "Church militant, it is not within your power to separate me from the church triumphant." And there you have it.
Wow.
There's essentially two churches. Dominionism is the church militant, the church of control. The church triumphant follows a God of love and inclusion. It's as if it's Machiavelli versus Jesus. Jesus has no problem with democracy. Equality and justice for all is implied in Jesus' teachings of love thy neighbor as thyself. And Jesus also made it clear that one's neighbor is the very person the church leaders of his day despise. One's neighbor is a Samaritan, a prostitute, a homosexual, a tax collector. All of these were despised in Jesus' day, but Jesus loved them, and he told us to do the same. So, in summary, I want to just get this thought out. It's a simple thing tonight. I just want to get this thought out. Don't be ashamed if you love the Lord. Speak up. Love thy neighbor is at the very core of what we stand for. And I believe that democracy is a natural extension of Christianity, and democracy is Christianity working in government. It's not the way these people would have you believe.
Well, Peter,
that's pretty,
you know,
much what was on my heart tonight. It's a short segment, but that's what I have to say rather than go on and just repeat myself. That's really what I wanted to get out.
Okay. Well, you know, and I really appreciate you coming on and sharing that with us. I mean, I think sometimes that we forget that true Christian principles are all about love and are all about inclusion and are all about helping each other and, you know, reaching out without without motive, to help those around us who may need our help, or even just a shoulder to let somebody share their feelings, and based on that alone, this present form of our government really doesn't mesh well with those principles.
No, it does not. It does not mesh well at all. And I fully believe that these people that call themselves Christians and lift his name up are among those that he will clearly say, get away from me. I do not know you.
Well, I really appreciate you spending some time with us this evening, and as we will do in the future at some point again, we will hear from Mr. Peter from from wonderful Tallahassee, Florida.
Yes, the Belle of the South. Bruce, I appreciate what you're doing. It's great to have a place to say these things, and I encourage others to get with you to schedule interviews. It's worth doing. What we have to say is worth hearing. Without each other, we are a little bit lost in this world today. The news coverage does not touch us, and we're ignored perhaps more so than any other time in history, I believe. We are ignored, both the political voices and the Christian voices that speak to love and unconditional democracy and faith.
Well, I totally agree, and that's why that was the vision of All Things Reconsidered, to reconsider all things. So, great to hear from you again, Peter, and I hope you have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, Bruce.
Okay.
Have a good evening.
Okay. And that was Peter G. from Tallahassee. Yeah, this is Bruce Birch, and you are listening to All Things Reconsidered. We have a few minutes left in our show tonight, and I wanted to make sure that there were some stories that did not get missed this evening. And just by the way, Peter is one of the people who has helped support this show also in other ways. So thank you very, very much, Peter, for everything that you've done to help us at All Things Reconsidered. And I say us because I'm, paranoid, schizophrenic. No, because I am me, myself, and I. But thank you, Peter. And also, I wanted to announce that 12th Harmonic, whom you can reach at 12thharmonic.com, who has done a number of parody songs that have been played on Mike Malloy, it has graciously decided to donate some WordPress blogs, which are pretty nifty blogs, to All Things Reconsidered for us to donate or for us to distribute to those who are who need these blogs. So we're going to run a little a fundraiser here in the very near future, and as a token of our appreciation, we'll be doing WordPress blogs to those to the first 10 people who donate. So keep your eye open on our webpage at www.thetruthis.us/ATR. And if you want to make a donation, please do so. And if not, it's fine too. Keep listening. That's what we want most of all. You just keep listening and keep sharing the good word, which is freedom, democracy, and liberty with all of your friends. Real briefly, there's a couple of stories that I wanted to run by you because I think it's absolutely imperative that you hear these tonight, because it looks like it's coming down. This was just off of the Time Online Edition website at time.com/time/magazine. And this is called Contingency Plan. It's written by Vivica Novak and Mike Allen. And I wonder if Vivica Novak is any relation to Bob. Bob Cussum Out Novak. But the story is called A Contingency Plan, and I'm just going to read you a couple little lines out of here because I think this is a very telling article to come out on the eve of, perhaps on the eve of indictments. We will see. But according to this article, Karl Rove has a plan. Even before testifying last week for the fourth time before a grand jury probing the leak of CIA operative Valerie Plame's identity, Bush senior advisor Rove and others at the White House had concluded that if indicted, he would immediately resign or possibly go on unpaid leave. Several legal and administration sources familiar with the thinking told Time. Resignation is the much more likely scenario, they say. The same would apply to Lewis Scooter Libby. I mean, okay, after you're 18, you got to give up nicknames like Scooter. I mean, you really do. But anyway, the vice president's chief of staff, who also faces a possible indictment. A former White House official says Rove's break with Bush would have to be clean. No giving advice from the sidelines for the sake of the administration. So, you know, we have stories like this coming out, and I think it's important. I thought it was important to get it across to you, whoever you are listening to this show tonight, because it looks, you know, in light of that, chances are we're going to see some activity this week. And the other story that I wanted to bring to you is out of The Nation, the October 24th edition of The Nation magazine. And if you don't get this magazine, then you're missing out on some of the best progressive stories that there are out there. This particular story, or this particular article, is called A Real Contract with America, and it's by Robert Borisuch. Something in the article was just sort of stood out at me, and I've said this before on this show. Matter of fact, I think I said it last show. And that is that the Republicans' contract with America 10 years later, 11 years later, has turned out to be a contract on America. They seized power in 94, and it's 2005 now, and we are now seeing the results of this contract, and the results are that, you know, the results are in. After 11 years, our economy is bereft. More people are unemployed. More people are unemployed than ever. We're just in bad shape as a nation. If you're electing a Republican out of security, look at Hurricane Katrina, and we saw that coming. That's all I have to say about that. Because the bottom line is they did not make us any safer. Okay. Now, the other thing, too, is that if you think you're going to elect a conservative to make you safer, how about just elect a Democrat to make you safe, period? Okay? So, having said that, the midterm elections are coming up next year, and Mark Ortiz, who was on the show tonight, is running for the 8th District, and he's going up against a very moneyed Republican, and if you can get in touch with Mark, please do help him out as best you can, or help out whichever candidate that you choose to help. But Mark seems to carry the ideals that this show espouses. Anyway, you can reach him at Mark Ortiz, O-R-T-I-Z, for Congress.org. Mark Ortiz for Congress.org. And that's going to bring us down tonight to the end of our show. This is All Things Reconsidered. My name is Bruce Birch, and I have been your host for the evening, and I just wanted to tell you that I'm very grateful to have been a part of your life for the night. We broadcast, or should I say netcast, or internets cast, here every Sunday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time until the first Sunday of November. And we also netcast simultaneously on the West Coast. I like this. Simultaneously on the West Coast at 7 p.m. streaming around the world on shoutcast.com, soon to be whiterosesociety.org. And the show is archived by Ben Birch at White Rose Society. You can reach me at all things at thetruthis.us, and remember to come check us out online. So thanks so much for letting us be a part of your life tonight, and
we certainly hope to be able to get back with you very soon. Stay tuned for Peter Werby from WRIF Night Call.
Pandemic coordinator, where? Within the White House, of course. More power to the president. The presidency in the United States is increasingly starting to look, you know, horribly and increasingly starting to look like some sort of kingdom, like some sort of kingship. It's like we're back to, you know, France in the 18th century. Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. Oh, let's just have another party. Black boots and caviar. And the people of the United States of America. That's the rabble, as John Adams used to say. Dr. Erwin Redler, Associate Dean of Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, Director of its National Center for Disaster Preparedness, said, "This is an extraordinarily draconian measure." He put it rather bluntly, just laid it out. He said, "The translation of this, martial law in the United States." You know, the Bushies have been wanting to declare martial law all along. You know, wouldn't it be a fine idea? Get rid of all...